Thunderstorms can pack gusty winds, but some storms contain winds called derechos. They are unusual and can be very destructive. Delving into derechos during this week's edition of Jet Streaming.
Stormy old weather, when the wind blows, we'll all pull together.
We are back for another week. This is Jet Streaming, the podcast that's devoted to all things weather-related. I'm Kathy Werzer. With us, Mark Seely, fresh from a relaxing vacation, complete with excellent weather, I'm sure.
For the most part, yes.
See, I thought good weather followed you everywhere you went.
Some people think otherwise.
I see. Mark's a climatologist and meteorologist with the University of Minnesota. Good to have him back. Craig Edwards is with us, too. He's the retired chief meteorologist with the National Weather Service office in the Twin Cities. How are you doing, Craig?
Good morning, Kathy. It's good to be back with you again.
You know, both you guys remember the big windstorm of July 4th, 1999, that blew down millions and millions of trees in northern Minnesota's Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness, which was, boy, it was a devastating storm. Do you remember that day, Mark?
I do remember that. I was down here in the Twin Cities for that storm, but I remember seeing the visualizations, both the satellite and the radar visualizations of what a mammoth storm and one of the longest lived derechos of recent memory.
And that was, when we talk about derechos, that is what did all the damage
up
there.
Yes, that's right. That was very devastating. And of course, we've been paying a price for that in the BWCA ever since, because we've had to pay careful attention to the massive fuel load that was left on the forest floor up there.
Right. You know, Craig, I did a little research on derechos, and I see they're associated with thunderstorms that are curved in shape, the so-called bow echo on the radar. And I thought bow echoes were indicative of tornadic activity, but are they also fingerprints of derechos?
Bow echoes, or what we call spear echoes, show straight-line wind damage, Kathy, and winds of up to 130 miles an hour. And some of those winds have rotation, particularly near the comma head portion of that bow echo, and research has been done on that for probably about three decades now that shows that you can have embedded tornado circulation. That, unfortunately, it's hard to pick out a tornado circulation when you have such devastation with 130 mile an hour winds. But if somebody can actually get a good visual on this storm as it's approaching, you might see some actual rotation and some tornado activity with a bow echo or derecho.
You know, on that July 4th day, a few hours away from the BWCA, was Marlon Bree, gentlemen. Marlon was sailing on Lake Superior when the winds hit, and he lived to tell his story. Marlon Bree is the author of Wake of the Green Storm, A Survivor's Tale. Marlon, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Set the scene. Where were you on the big lake?
I was just across the Canadian border heading for what I thought was a shelter at the mouth of Thunder Bay called Thompson Island. And I looked over my shoulder at this crown, what I thought was fog, following me in the Sawtooth Mountains. And suddenly, there it was, some big monster that simply jumped over the Sawtooth, and then I was in it.
I hear that it was determined that this was a progressive derecho. That's pretty rare, I understand.
I understand it is, too. I did a lot of work with the Storm Prediction Center out of Norman, Oklahoma, after I got back, because I was greatly puzzled about what had happened to me, especially since the papers and the media here in the Twin Cities were reporting 80-mile-an-hour winds, and I just did not believe all of the, reports that I was getting, because the damage up there that I saw on the ground after I finally got to shelter was horrific, with centuries-old trees torn up by the roots and laying on their sides.
Marlon, of course, we all know wind speed is affected greatly by the roughness of the surface or the surrounding terrain.
Yes.
And, of course, there's a lot of friction induced by the forest as well as the rolling landscape up in that area of Lake Superior. It's not out of the question that winds aloft and unobstructed winds across Lake Superior could have been much, much higher than what was reported by the National Weather Service.
That's what I understand. The guy I was talking with that's setting up the NOAA website said, Elmer Johns said that, no, Robert Johns said that wind speed over Lake Superior may have increased 5 to 10%.
Mm.
So that would have been a I wish I had a speedometer. As it is, all I had was a small 20-foot sailboat that was in the grip of this thing, and we were having quite a time of it.
Well, let's talk about that here briefly. When did you know you were in big trouble?
Right after the heavy winds started to hit. I have a little unofficial wind speed gauge on my boat called the Shrouds, and I've heard various wind speeds in the 20, 30 years or so that I've been sailing on Lake Superior. And here the wind in the rigging started to shriek and then howl and then go off the scale in something that I hadn't heard before. And something like a giant hand sort of gripped the top of the mast and started levering the entire boat down into the water. And at that point, the boat bucked, stopped, and did a semi-pitch pole, and I flew forward into the cabin down below. And there were some more shrieks, and I saw water coming up through the centerboard trunk, and I saw my starboard port light turn an interesting shade of green, and that's when I realized that the side of the boat was underwater.
Oh, my goodness. My goodness. Craig Edwards, I know there were warnings out there for this storm, but obviously a sailor like Marlin, it seemed to be caught off guard.
Well, I'm trying to get a handle on this whole thing because from what I was looking at with regard to the history of this storm, that it looked like there was quite a bit of wind already reported in portions of north central Minnesota. And as the storm was racing through the boundary water canoe area there, that they had warnings out, they were concerned about it, saw it well on radar. And it looked to me like from mid-morning on to about early afternoon, there was enough indications, particularly on a holiday, that people should have been cautious as far as going out sailing, because this storm actually looked like it was starting from even early morning hours, racing across portions of northern Minnesota. And I was wondering what you knew before you set out on the waters, or what time of the day were you on the waters and had an awareness for the weather and the overall circumstances?
Oh, sure. First thing I do on Superior is turn on my NOAA weather on VHF, and I was getting the weather forecast that said 4th of July would be the hottest day of the year with fair winds, but a thunderstorm possibility late afternoon. And since I was starting out of that old fur fort Grand Portage and heading up toward the Canadian border, I thought I'd easily make it. The only indication I had was that the weather was indeed fluky. There was heavy fog on the lake as I started out, ducking in and out of fog banks. And as I progressed, the weather brightened, and indeed I thought this was going to be a wonderful day on Superior. And I actually had my destination in sight, which is Thompson Island, when all of this happened. As I understand it, it was simply a thunderstorm that started out on the border of Minnesota, had 60-mile-an-hour winds. This kicked up to 80-mile-an-hour winds sometime in the Boundary Waters canoe area, when it combined to be a perfect storm, that rare progressive derecho that roared across the Boundary Waters, downed millions of trees, and went out the Atlantic coast and back. There was no warning where I was, other than a brief klaxon sound from Thunder Bay Coast Guard on their weather, because I was now in Canadian waters, and it said heavy weather warning. And then I heard the report that a sailboat had overturned and boaters were in the water. And then it was on me, but the derecho was never announced. And I understand from the Storm Prediction Center that the nature of the derecho is such as that it cannot be predicted in advance. And I've been to various websites, including the Natural History Museum, which shows that radar, that bow-shaped echo forming, but it does so briefly, and then the Duluth Weather Service loses that echo. Hmm. So we had sometime during that morning the story of a warning that high winds were coming eastward, although that did not reach me through NOAA weather. Some of the people that were in the boundary waters and in Grand Marais, I just returned from Grand Marais last weekend talking with some of those people, and they said there was some warning that a windstorm was coming, but no mention has ever been made of a derecho during the time of its formation or its actual toppling of millions of trees in the boundary waters, which is an unfortunate thing because this is an exceedingly dangerous storm and one which is of particular dangers to campers and boaters during July.
Absolutely. You know, both Mark and Craig as experts here, is it difficult to predict a derecho?
Well, I think since the 99 storm, the SPC, the Storm Prediction Center, has developed better methods for forecasting these, and in fact, they often present the situation in their forecast discussion. So I think there's been some improvement in that regard, although their development can be rather rapid, and therefore the warning time can be rather short on these types of storms. Fortunately, these types of storms are far less frequent than simple severe thunderstorms or tornadoes or things like that. But
interesting.
Yeah.
And Craig, how would you describe to the uninitiated how this would form in a storm, the derecho?
Well, what you have is you have boundaries that set up, and then you have a strong jet max over the top of you with winds of maybe 80 to 90 miles an hour at 20 to 30,000 feet, and these thunderstorms ascend above that level. They capture these winds, and they drag them down to the surface, and so you have an acceleration of the movement of these storms. But, Kathy, I know Bill Togstad at the National Weather Service in Chanhassen did a study on the May 30th and 31st storm of 1998, and that storm was very long-lived with 130-mile-an-hour winds that went through just south of the Twin Cities and on into Wisconsin, all the way over to Milwaukee. So once they form, and you see it on radar with the radar coverage, there should be 20 to 30-minute warning on these storms, even though they're moving maybe at 40 to 50 miles an hour. The dilemma the Weather Service has is when you say a severe thunderstorm, that usually means maybe some dime-sized hail and 60-mile-an-hour winds. So you almost have to ratchet this up a notch by saying this is a very dangerous storm. And in the Weather Service, we used to have a term called very severe thunderstorm, but that was a little bit confusing, so we just call them severe thunderstorm warnings now. And I think the issue that has to be made with these types of storms is there needs to be more urgency and more emergency type information shared, saying we have a very dangerous storm, even more dangerous sometimes than a tornado warning. Because if you have a wind of 120, 130 miles an hour, and you'll have an F0 tornado, that's only 75-mile-an-hour winds. So you can have stronger winds during a derecho than you have during a lot of the tornadoes in Minnesota.
I got to ask Marlon here. When last we left your story, you were underwater pretty much in terms of part of your boat, Marlon. How in the world did you escape dying, really?
Well, for a while I was very concerned that I was going under and would have to start swimming up to the top of my keel, and it was my hope then that I would sit atop the boat and be blown probably out into the middle of Superior, at which time I would start worrying about getting back. But finally, what happened was that after the initial gusts went through, and I just don't know how much microburst energy there was, but it was substantially in excess of 100 miles an hour, I guess. The winds went ratcheted down somewhat to maybe 60 or 80 miles an hour, and I had hurt myself going into the cabin because I was simply thrown in there because the boat bow dug in under speed, and I was thrown forward, much like a bully on a teeter-totter tosses the lesser occupant. I picked myself out, went out to the cabin, went out to the cockpit, and just in time to see three heavy fenders, rubber fenders, that I had laid out for my arrival in Thompson Cove go one by one up into the sky for some reason. And finally, what happened was that as the boat bucked around, the engine was out of the water, the rudder was out of the water, and as it went over, I simply tossed myself over the side enough to put my weight on the side of the boat, since this is an ultra-lightweight centerboard 20-foot boat. I had some effect. When the wind finally went down, the boat simply plopped back down in the water. The mast came back up, and the spetters at times were touching the water. And I could head off successfully, and I simply turned it around, turned the outboard up to full throttle, and headed for the nearest pile of rocks that I could find, at which point I simply rode out much of the storm behind the rocks, keeping my speed up, and I was in the cockpit. Incidentally, it's a couple of things about this wind. It's a downward wind that's pressing on you. It is very violent during the open phase, and it's also very cold. Now, for that 4th of July day on Superior, I was wearing long johns, winter fleece, and a boater's jacket with fleece on the inside, and I was in some state of hyperthermia. I was shivering so badly.
Wow.
My goodness. What did that wind burst do to wave heights on the lake? Did they go up substantially?
No, actually, everyone asked me that, and they said, we must be in terrible waves and all of that sort of thing. And actually, the downburst came, and it smashed the water flat. And when I first emerged from the cockpit there after the pitch pull, I looked out, and there were simply long furrows of spume thousands of feet long and maybe 20 to 30 feet in diameter, writhing like snakes on the water all around me.
Marlin, your tale is amazing. Goodness sakes.
It was very interesting. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you joining us and telling us a little bit about what happened to you way back there in 1999. And it's interesting to note what these derechos can do. I mean, just the power of them. It's pretty amazing.
It was a learning experience for me, certainly. I learned about derechos for the first time, and I'm so glad that to hear from the learned guests that we are getting some better weather reporting going, and that people are now starting to get informed about derechos. And thank you for your broadcast.
Well, Marlin Bree, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Very interesting. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Marlin's story can be found on the NOAA website, by the way, under derechos, and his website is marlinbree.com.
The storms are on the ocean, the heavens may cease to be, this world may lose its motion, love, if I prove false to thee.
As an end note to our discussion on derechos, Mark Seely helped with a video with on derechos. What's the story on that one, by the way?
It's just titled Derechos. It's one of the Earth bulletins that's hosted by the American Museum of Natural History in New York City.
I think we'll try to put that link up on our website, too.
Great.
Good job. We really appreciate hearing from the partakers of this podcast, by the way. We want to know who's out there. Hope you'll drop us a line and tell us that, yes, you listen. And if you have ideas on how to improve the experience, tell us that, too. We have a special form to fill out by going to the podcast section of MinnesotaPublicRadio.org and go to Jet Streaming. We do have a listener question, by the way, and it deals with derechos. Here's the question. Mark, you can take this. I read about a national study concerning derechos like the one that devastated Minnesota's BWCA in July of 1999. How many of these occur each year?
Well, according to a recent study by the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, Kathy, about 8 to 12 of these storms occur across the nation each year, so they're very, very much less frequent than so many other severe weather types that we report on. Thankfully so, because they cut a damage swath that's anywhere from 25 to 50 miles across. We have seen them about on average about every 3 years. There's no regularity, though. They may come sometimes in clusters, and then we may go years without seeing any. Certainly in our lifetime, the real devastating ones we've seen across our region would be 1995 that flattened the Itasca State Park, 1999, the BWCA storm that we just talked about. And we've also seen them historically, though, back in 1902. Now that we know what they are, we can go back with the data and sort of reconstruct them, if you will. Back in 1902, there was another mammoth progressive derecho that crossed Minnesota and flattened crop fields, uprooted trees, and destroyed dozens and dozens of farm buildings. We didn't know what it was at the time, but now we've gone back and studied it and determined that it was a derecho. It was on July 15 and 16 of 1902.
Wow, good information. Thank you, Mark. And as always, we're going to finish the program with a weather website of the week. Yes, the thunder roll. And Craig, what site have you picked?
Well, Kathy, we're in the heart of the season where you can have everything from derechos to heat to severe thunderstorms to lightning and even hurricanes. So I'd like to advertise the redcross.org that has all sorts of safety information on there for to keep our summer safe, particularly related to weather events. So redcross.org has got enough information on there to keep you safe for the rest of the summer, and hopefully people will use that as a source of information for education and safety.
Excellent. Thank you, Craig. By the way, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Thank you, and thanks, Mark. Thanks for coming back from vacation.
You're welcome. I'm glad I did. It was a very interesting program today.
It was. Thank you. We're out of time at this point for Jet Streaming. Thank you to Julie Seipel for producing Jet Streaming. This is her maiden voyage. Special thanks to Larissa Anderson for all her work on Jet Streaming. Again, if you have a question for us, go to MinnesotaPublicRadio.org and click on Jet Streaming. We'll be here next week, automatically popping up on your MP3 player or downloadable at MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. Until next week, remember to keep your eyes on the sky.
Rushing through my veins, high, low pressure in the back of my brain. Mr. Weatherman, why is my baby so cold? Well, I've been watching you on Channel 13. You seem to know a lot about the weather scene. Give me the news.